Okay, I'll begin. So today, homework set 6 is due. I've just posted homework set 7. Homework set 6 dealt with finding bases for the subspaces that are attached to a matrix. So we did lots of examples last week, but I'm wondering if there are any questions on those WebAssign problems. Well, hopefully that's good news. So what we're going to do today is I introduced last time subspaces are special subsets that are the most important subsets of a vector space that one considers in linear algebra. And similarly, for functions, we have a special class of functions that are relevant to linear algebra. These are the so-called linear transformations. So I introduced those last Friday. We're going to talk more about them today, but the main thing I want to do is take the abstract stuff, all the definitions and stuff, and relate it to our concrete calculational setting of matrices. So the first half of today's lecture is going to be to take the idea of a function between two vector spaces and associate with it a particular matrix. And then we'll find that there's a really tight association connection between matrices and linear transformation. Basically, it's one-to-one. For every linear transformation, you have a matrix, and for every matrix, you have a linear transformation. So that should suggest, particularly in light of what we did last week, that since matrices have like three subspaces that we can naturally associate with them, the span of the columns, the span of the rows, and the solution set, the corresponding linear system. Well, because linear translations are related to matrices, you would expect with there's some special subspaces associated with a linear transformation, just like there are for matrices. And in fact, we're going to talk about two subspaces associated with linear transformation. What's nice about these is their definitions, even though they relate directly to the sort of subspaces we considered for matrices, they're defined just using functional language rather than linear algebra language. Yet, when we try to calculate them, we'll see that we go back to matrices to actually figure out precisely what a given range of a transformation is, or what the kernel of a linear transformation is. Okay, so let's let me start today's lecture with reviewing real quickly what a linear transformation is. We've been looking at these vector spaces throughout for the whole semester. Now we're going to consider functions that map one vector space to another. What we require for a linear transformation is it should take us from one vector space to another, but it's also got to behave well with respect to our fundamental vector space operations. So if we scale or multiply a vector before we apply the function, we should get the same result as if we just applied it directly to V and then postponed the scalar multiplication until after we applied the function. And similarly, we should be able to add vectors before we apply the transformation or after we apply the transformation, and we would get the same result. So it's basically a compatibility property that we're imposing on functions between our two vector spaces. We want them to be compatible with our two fundamental vector space operations. Okay, so those are the objects we're going to be dealing with, special functions that for which these properties can be maintained. Now, one really prototypical example of how you make a linear transformation is to start with any matrix, n rows and n columns. Once you have a matrix specified, you can create a linear transformation that takes you from, well, the number of columns you have, that corresponding Rm, to the number of rows you have, Rn. And the way that's done is you take a vector inside the domain, you reinterpret it as a column vector so that you can perform matrix multiplication. So remember how matrix multiplication works. If you have an n by n matrix, and you have a column vector, so a matrix with m rows and one column, then what's going to produce from this matrix multiplication? It's going to produce n, well, you have the match you need, and then the outside dimensions give you the dimensions of the product. So you get an n by one matrix, which you can think of as an ordered list of n numbers. And so this guy lives inside Rm, but after we multiply by A, we get an element in Rn. So that's easy way to create a function between two vector spaces. And what we do to find the linear transformation that will attach to this matrix is we'll simply define its action on an m-dimensional vector as being matrix multiplication by your given matrix. All right, and then it's easy to see that this is a linear transformation because, T of lambda x, T of lambda x, let me put a subscript A because I'm going to define this function in terms of this matrix A. So that's all this subscript means. I'm specified A, now I've got a linear transformation, and what this is going to be by the definition of this function is just going to be A times, well, the argument is lambda x. But scalar multiplication commutes with vector matrix multiplication. So this is the same thing as A. We can just reverse the order of those multiplications, and then we get lambda times AX, which is lambda times T subscript A of x, because A times x is exactly what we mean by this function T subscript A. So here you see the compatibility with scalar multiplication. And similarly, if we have a sum of vectors and we apply this function to it, well, by definition of this function, this is A times x plus y, then I can distribute that over the vector sum, and we get T of x plus T of y. And so we also have the natural compatibility with vector addition. So both scalar multiplication and vector addition are preserved by this function. What I'm going to show today is that the converse is also true. This is saying that if I have a matrix, I can create a linear transformation. The goal for today is to show that if you have a linear transformation, you can find a corresponding matrix. So I'll state this a little more precisely. Anytime you have a function between two vector spaces that are for which scalar multiplication and vector addition are preserved, then there's going to be a corresponding matrix. I'll label it A subscript T rather than T subscript K, because now the input is a function and our output is going to be a particular matrix. And my claim is that once I have a function that has those properties, that I can find a matrix such that the action of T on any vector can be replicated by matrix multiplication. This is sort of similar to what we did with elementary matrices, where we had elementary row operations, and we found that we can implement them directly by matrix multiplication. Now what I'm going to show you is that you have an arbitrary function, well, not an arbitrary function, but an arbitrary linear transformation between two vector spaces, that can be implemented by matrix multiplication. Okay, but to show this, it's going to require a couple simple short digressions. We'll need a better formula for matrix multiplication in particular. All right, so that's in fact the content of that first lemma, how to find a simple statement about what it means to multiply a column vector by a matrix. So the statement we'll quickly show is that if you, let me just denote by column subscript JA for the jth column of a matrix, meaning, let's see, this column J of A would be the column vector. Well, let's see, I'm going to be in the jth column, but the row index is changing, A2J, ANJ. So these are the entries of the jth column of the general n by n matrix. A equals A11, A1M, AN1, ANM, and all the entries in between. So that's all this noting. I'm just grabbing a particular column of this matrix, and I'm denoting it by column J. So the statement I'm going to make is that when you multiply a column vector times a matrix, the result can be thought of as a particular linear combination of the columns of A. And in fact, the coefficients in this expansion are exactly the entries of the vector that's being multiplied by A. So if you know the components of X and you know the columns of your matrix, then an alternative way to compute this product is just to take this linear combination of the columns. All right, so why is that true? Well, it really can be demonstrated in just a couple lines, right? Here's a matrix product, an arbitrary n by m matrix times an arbitrary m dimensional column vector. We compute this by taking the dot product of the rows of the first factor with the one and only column of the second factor, and we get this. But now we can do an operation that we've done many times. For example, when we solve linear systems, we'll expand this particular vector with respect to these parameters, x1, x2, up to xm. So x1 is multiplying first column of A. If you look what x1 is multiplying, in each term, in each component, I'm getting an entry in the first column times the first entry of x. And then the second column, if you look at it, it's just going to be the entries in the second column of A, but they're all multiplying the second component of x2. So if I simply expand the vector that results from doing the matrix multiplication, if I expand it in terms of the variables x1 through xm, you see that I get exactly a linear combination of the columns of the original matrix. Okay, so we'll use this identity. It gives us another way, alternative way of computing these matrix products. All right, now the second thing I want to talk a little bit about is the so-called standard basis for RM. We haven't used it that much, but let me remind you, it's just the easy basis you get by take, taking all m-dimensional vectors and specializing to the ones where only one component is non-zero and that component is equal to one. So the first standard basis vector is where the first component is one and all other components are equal to zero. The second standard basis vector is where only the second component is non-zero and the second component is equal to one, etc. So we have these so-called standard basis vectors for Rm. But now you see the purpose of our language here. If I think of these just as an arbitrary set of vectors sitting inside Rm, then, well, one thing that's obvious is I can reach any vector inside Rm by taking linear combinations of these guys, right? Because pretty easy to see. Well, in fact, the next line will show you that. Well, not so easily. Okay, so what I'm saying here is that you take a vector x1 through xm, then you can think of it as x1 times e1 plus x2 times e2 plus xm times em. So, because if you just use this definition for these standard basis vectors, this identity is sort of obvious. But what it shows is that every vector inside your m-dimensional space can be expanded and written as a linear combination of these standard basis vectors E1 through EM. So that's the first point, that every vector inside your vector space is a linear combination of these guys. But that doesn't mean that these guys are a basis yet. You not only have to be able to reach every point in your space, but you have these. You need these guys to be linearly independent if you're going to have a basis. But it's pretty clear that these guys are linearly independent. Well, maybe the simplest way to demonstrate that is to notice that a linear combination of these vectors is going to equal the zero vectors. If that equals the zero vector, then each of these components has to equal zero. And that means that each of these expansion coefficients separately have to equal zero. So x equals zero, that linear combination equals zero only if, zero, zero, zero equals x1 e1 plus dot, dot, dot plus xm em. If and only if x1 equals 0, x2 is equal to 0, and xm is equal to 0. So the only linear combination that produces a zero vector is a trivial linear combination, and that's the definition of linear independence. So these particular vectors not only generate the entire vector space, they're linearly independent. And for that reason, they're a basis. Okay, that's just recalling our definitions of bases and linear independence, et cetera. Okay, so one thing to note about this basis, and the reason why I never talked about it, I may have mentioned it, but I haven't really dealt with it that much. If you recall, I introduced bases as a way of coordinatizing vector spaces. The idea is that if B equals B1 through BK is a basis for, say, a subspace S, then S can be coordinatized. So what do? You take a vector, say little s inside S. The fact that you have a basis for that, these vectors, means that S has an expansion, in fact, a unique expansion in terms of these basis vectors. C, K, B, K. So once you have a basis, it means every vector can be expanded in terms of your given basis. And moreover, these coefficients are unique. And so what we glean from that is that we can ascribe coordinates to this vector using C1 to CK. Are the coordinates of the given vector S inside a subspace. And that's what we needed, because in general, the individual vectors are going to live in a large dimensional space, but the subspace we're interested is of lower dimension. So we want to have our coordinates attuned to our subspace, not the space in which the vectors actually live. Well, what happens when we do that that construction to the standard basis vectors? Well, here, the reason why I never talked about it is because it turns out to be really trivial in this case. You have an arbitrary list of m numbers. So here it's written out. Then you can expand it in terms of the standard basis vectors, because these, in fact, are a basis for Rm. But then, according to this rule, when we want to coordinatize Rm, what we could do is expand in terms of the basis and then using the coefficients as the coordinates. So when we do that, when we grab the coefficients and the expansion with respect to the basis and we put them in a vector, well, the vector we get is the same as the vector we started off with. And so the standard basis vector is unique in that its coordinate vectors, anytime you expand a vector in terms of it and grab the coefficients, you get the same vector that you started off with. Okay, so that's just peculiar to the standard basis vector. What we've been, I never mentioned this before because actually our goal, as I was trying to teach you about a basis, is not to rely on the standard basis vector. Okay, so, all right, so now I'll show you the connection between a linear transformation and how I can get a matrix from a function between two vector spaces. What we'll do is I'll form a matrix. I'll construct it explicitly. And here it is. So each of these standard basis vectors for Rm, it's going to be an m-dimensional vector. So this function can be applied to it, and I'm going to get an n-dimensional vector as a result. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the result of these, and I'm going to write the resultant vector vertically, not horizontally, but vertically. And I'll do it once for each of the standard basis vectors. So if m is m-dimensional, there'll be m standard basis vectors to which I can apply the linear transformation and thereby generate a particular column of this matrix. All right, so the claim then is that if you construct this matrix using the standard basis vectors for the domain and the function itself, then in fact, matrix multiplication by this matrix replicates the action of the function when applied directly to the same vector. So I can either operate directly on the elements of Rm by applying the function, or I can implement this function by doing a matrix multiplication. All right, so let me show you why that's true. Here's the definition of what this matrix is. All I need to do to write it down is a specific function t and knowledge of how it acts on those standard basis vectors. So, so this is what we want to show. And so let's start computing. T of x is going to be t applied to, well, x. I'll expand it in terms of the standard basis. Well, that's just expanding an arbitrary vector inside the domain with respect to the standard basis, the E1s to the EMs. But then, because linear transformations are compatible with vector addition, I can delay these vector sums until after I apply the linear transformation. Then, let me move this up a little bit. Then linear transformations are also compatible with scalar multiplication. I can do the scalar multiplication before I apply the function or after I apply the function, and the result is to be the same if T is a linear transformation. So I get this, and that's just because T preserves scalar multiplication. But now I recognize this guy as being the first column of this matrix. Second entry here would be the second column of this matrix, and the last summon, which is going to be XM times the last column of that matrix. So this expansion is exactly this. And now, if you recall our matrix multiplication identity, the product of a matrix times a vector, that can be computed by taking the components of this vector and multiplying the respective columns of this matrix and then summing everything up. And so this particular linear combination of the columns of this matrix is exactly A times X, that matrix times X. And so we've got it. The goal was to find a, given a function between two vector spaces, the goal was to find a matrix that would implement that function directly via matrix multiplication. And what I've shown you is that this particular matrix works. And in fact, if now I have a matrix that defines a linear transformation. If I took this matrix and I used it to define a linear transformation via this rule, in fact, so I'm working backwards now. Suppose I was given this matrix and I use it to define a linear transformation. Well, I get back the original linear transformation. So in fact, there's a one-to-one correspondence between functions that preserve scalar multiplication in vector addition and matrices. All right, so let's do an explicit example. Try to position this a little better. Okay, so here's a function. It's going to take three-dimensional vectors, the two-dimensional vectors, the components of the image is just going to be the difference between the first two components, and the second component of the image vector is going to be the sum of the last two components of the input vector. All right, so first thing I'll do, I'll show you that this is indeed a linear transformation. Let's first check that it's compatible with scalar multiplication. So I'll apply T to a scalar multiple of X, and the question I want to check is, does this equal lambda times T of X? That's the compatibility with scalar multiplication property that a linear transformation must have. So let's start computing. When I do the scalar multiplication, I just bring the factor of lambda inside. And now I can apply this rule for the function T. It's just that what I'm going to have to do is substitute for x1 here, I'll substitute lambda x1. For x2, I'll substitute lambda x2 into the right-hand side of that that mapping. This is what we get. The difference of the first two components of the argument, and then the second component is the sum of the last two components of the argument. And we have a common factor of lambda in each term in each component. So I pull that factor out, and then you see that this is just lambda times T applied to the original vector x1, x2, x3. And so I verified this identity that the function T applied to lambda times X is the same thing, same result as lambda scalar multiplying the value of T at the point X. All right, so T is compatible with scalar multiplication. And in these examples, I'm referring to this particular function. Was there a question? All right, so let me show you that this particular function is also compatible with vector addition. So I'll apply the function to a sum of vectors. Here's two generic vectors, I'll add them together. And now I've got T applied to a particular vector, I'll compute it. So again, I take the difference of the first two components to get the first component of the image point, and then I'll sum the last two components to get the the second component of the image point. And then I'll just rearrange terms a little bit. I'll get the x terms, group them together, and the y terms, I'll group them together. And then what you see is we can separate this vector sum into terms that involve only the components of x and terms that involve only the components of the vector y. And that's exactly t of x times t of y, the difference of the first two components and the sum of the second two components. All right, so this function, defined by this formula, does satisfy the essential properties of a linear transformation. It's compatible with scalar multiplication, as shown on the last slide, and it's compatible with vector addition, as shown on this slide. And so it is a linear transformation. All right, so that's just verifying that we're dealing with a function that has the right properties. Let's now construct the corresponding matrix, A subscript T. So the way that's done, again, is by attaching a matrix to that linear transformation, where the ith column, or maybe called the jth column, of the matrix A subscript T is T applied to the J standard basis vector. So what I'm doing in these three lines here is I'm computing how this function acts on these standard basis vectors. Let me again adjust this a little bit. So when T is applied to the first standard basis vector, I'll substitute 1, 0, 0 for the coordinates x1, x2, x3. And what's going to happen is I'll get 1 minus 0 and 0 plus 0 for the result of applying T to this particular vector. And similarly for the other two standard basis vectors. All right, now, most common mistake on the second exam, I'll tell you right away, is saying that this means that don't want you writing it down. So this does not mean that AT is equal to 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 1. That's not true. Because there's one thing that you're missing here. You found out how T acts on the standard basis vectors, but you've written the result in the wrong way. If you go back to the matrix I wrote down, back here, way back, several slides back. Here it is, it's just not showing up very well. The instruction for forming this matrix is to write these guys as columns, not as rows. And so what I really need to do, once I've computed the action of my given function on the standard basis vectors, what I need to do to get the right matrix is to write the results, not as rows, but as columns. And so this first row I've written here, actually this first result, the first standard basis vector, that gives you the first column of the corresponding matrix. The action of T on the second standard basis vector gives you the second column. That's really necessary so that that matrix will do what we want. If we have T that's going from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors, and we want this to be replicated by a vector getting sent to matrix multiplication of the vector by this particular matrix, what are we going to need? Well, first of all, our input vector is going to be m-dimensional. So that's going to be an m by 1 matrix. And our what is this matrix going to be? It's going to be, the way we've constructed it, it's got exactly m columns and n rows. So this would be an n by M matrix. And that works because the inner dimensions match. And so what we'll get out of this matrix multiplication is going to be an N by 1 matrix, and that we can regard as an ordered list of N numbers. But if I tried to use this matrix instead of this matrix, it wouldn't have worked because my input vector is still going to be three-dimensional. So if I took this, let me write this tilde. It's not actually the matrix we want, but A tilde T times X1, X2, X3. Well, that's going to be 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 1 times X1, X2, X3. And then notice that this matrix multiplication is not defined. Here we have a matrix of two columns multiplying a column vector with three entries. So the number of columns of the first factor does not equal the number of rows of the second factor. So this is undefined. So when you look for the matrix attached to a linear transformation, well, given a formula like this, this is a natural way to write the answer of what happens when you apply T to a standard basis vector. You have to remember that these vectors here have to be converted to columns in order to get the right matrix. All right, so I don't want to belabor that point too much because what I fear is you'll only remember this calculation and you'll forget to convert the things in the columns. Don't do that. But so long as you construct this matrix exactly as I prescribed it here, you'll get the right matrix, and it will replicate the action of your function on vectors. You'll replicate them simply by doing matrix multiplication. So I think I have a slide that demonstrates that explicitly. Maybe I don't. Well, yeah, here it is. So this is the matrix I constructed using the columns of T applied to the standard, using as columns the result applying our given transformation to the standard basis vectors. And then when I multiply an arbitrary three-dimensional vector by that matrix, I get this result. And then notice that I'm replicating the action here. This first component of the result is just x1 minus x2, as in with the original function. And the second component of the result is exactly the second component of the original thing. So indeed, we are replicating the action of that function via matrix multiplication by this particular matrix. Okay, so now we can bounce back and forth between linear transformations and matrices. What I'm going to talk about next is subspaces that are attached to a linear transformation. So let me review first what we did with matrices. Once we have a matrix, here I'm just saying the connection. But once we have a matrix, we consider three associated subspaces. We could take the row vectors of the matrix and consider all possible linear combinations. That generates a subspace of Rm called the row space. Or we can take the column vectors of A, take all possible linear combinations of them. That generates a subspace of Rn. And last thing we could do is we can use the matrix to create a homogeneous linear system and then study the solution set of the linear system. That is also a subspace. We call that the null space of the matrix. So as soon as I write down a matrix, I have three associated subspaces. What I'll show you now is that, in fact, the column space of a matrix and the null space of a matrix are going to be relevant also towards the subspaces we can attach to a linear transformation. And in fact, I could do that indirectly. I could take a matrix, a linear transformation T, create its corresponding matrix, A subscript T, and then look at the row space, column space, and null spaces for that matrix A subscript T. But I'm going to introduce two subspaces attached to a linear transformation, not by referring back to the a matrix reformulation of the problem, but rather by stressing the some functional properties of this function. So what I'm going to look at are two special subsets. One of the domain of the function. So here we have T going from Rm to Rn. This is your domain, and it's a vector space. And this the set that once you land on is called the codomain. Now, anytime you have a function that maps one set to another set, you have some special subsets associated with the domain and the codomain. The image of F, well, what this consists of is all the points in the target space, the codomain B, that can be reached by applying this function. So this is going to be the set of points in your codomain such that that point is the result of applying your function F to some point inside your domain. That set of points is called the image of your function. And we have a similar idea if we just specialized our functions to be linear transformations so that the domain and codomain are actually vector spaces. In this case, the range of a linear transformation, this is defined as its image. But for linear transformation, we use this more specialized language. It is exactly the image according to just being a function between two sets. The image is always created this way. But I'll write it out explicitly. It's going to consist of vectors. So same vectors in the domain. It's going to consist of vectors living in the codomain such that that vector is reachable by applying the linear transformation x for some x inside the domain. All right, so that's a set. Every element in that set is a vector sitting inside Rm. What I'll show you is that, in fact, this set is actually a subspace of Rm. I'm sorry, I didn't, it was so hard to see. All right, it's going to become apparent on the slides anyway. I can get my. There we go. All right, so here's what I said with the image. You just take, you can create the image by simply applying the function f to every point that lives in the domain and collecting everything together into a single set. Or you can think of it as all the points in the codomain that are reachable by applying that function f to some element in A. And then here's the specialization of this idea to a linear transformation, where the restriction is now I'm looking at particular functions that are compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition, and that map one vector space into another. And we call that the range. So it's actually a subspace because, well, what do we need to show? We need to show that this set is closed under both scalar multiplication and vector addition. But it's pretty easy to do that. If I take any vector inside the range, so T is going to map some vector inside the domain onto this point, and let lambda be any point in any real number. What I'll show you is the scalar multiple of y by lambda is still in that same set. So here's the argument. Let me start off with a point that sits inside that set, inside the range, and let lambda be any real number. What I want to show is that lambda times y is still inside this set. Okay, now, because y is in the range, it means that y had to come from some point of x by the application of the function t. And so that means that t of lambda x, because it's a linear transformation, I can delay this scalar multiplication until after I apply the function. So I move this factor of lambda through the linear transformation. But now I have lambda times t of y. So what is that? To get the statement I want, I have to read this backwards. This particular vector, lambda times y, is in the range of t because it's realizable by applying the function t to this particular point in the domain. So to show that this guy is in the range, I have to show you that it came from some point in the domain. But this, if you look at the extreme side, it's showing you exactly that, that this point actually came from this point inside the domain. And so the set is closed under scalar multiplication, because if you start off in that set, you multiply by a number lambda, you're still inside that set. Yeah. Lambda, so if we want to show a subspace, and this is the confusing part, because both linear transformations, the functions, and the subspaces, the sets, behave a certain way with scalar multiplication. For subspaces, what we want is that if you take a number and you take an element that lives inside your subspace, what you want is that lambda times that vector is still inside your subspace. And for you also require that if you start off with two vectors that start off in your subspace and then you add them together, that you're still inside that subspace. So this is the requirements for a subspace. And it's requirements that we're putting on a set, not on a function. For a linear transformation, we have two requirements as well. But this time, it's the requirement is if you start off with a number and a vector, let's call this t from Rm to Rn. We start off with a number and a vector in the domain, then necessarily t of lambda times x has to equal lambda times t of x. So it's a compatibility property of this function. Here we're talking about the ability to stay inside the same subspace. And here we're basically talking about a compatibility property, our ability to delay scalar multiplication until after we apply the function. So they're different, but they're similar. And we also have, if we have two vectors, x1 and x2, that start off in the domain of our function, after we add them together, well, we can add them together and then apply the function, or we could apply the function to the individual vectors and do the vector sum after we apply the function. If these two properties hold, we have a special family of functions. If these two properties hold, we have a special subset. So they're very similar. And in fact, keeping with a basic theme of this course is that compatibility with scalar multiplication and vector addition gives all the structure to linear algebra. That in that sense, we should have some property of functions that's analogous to this, these properties of sets. But because they're different objects, there are going to be different senses of compatibility. All right, so what I showed, yeah.
So like we have the linear transformation that can be characterized by a matrix, and that matrix has subspaces that follow these rules.
Be careful. Keep things distinct. I guess what I want to say, yes, we can attach matrices to these things, and in fact, when we actually try to calculate things like this, we're going to use matrices because those are just concrete numerical objects that we can manipulate using just arithmetic. So yeah, there will be eventually there will be an implication. But in fact, what I'll show you is that the subspaces that when we actually figure out appropriate subspaces, that we'll be able to relate them to the subspaces that we could calculate from matrices. So just bear with, oh shoot, I'm out of time. Let me just flash quickly forward because it sort of answers your question. The way we can actually write down, so I'll show this again on Wednesday, that the range of T is actually a subspace of the domain. But what I'll show you is that this range, which is defined just using this this functional definition. To create the range, all I do is figure out every point I can reach by applying the linear transformation. Separate from that is my ability, once given a linear transformation, to write down the corresponding matrix. What I'll show you next time is this range that's defined just using the functional properties of the linear transformation, that could actually be calculated as the column space of this matrix. And so since we know how to find bases for column spaces, we'll also be able to find bases for the range of the corresponding matrices. And there's another subspace that we'll be able to attach to effectively the null space of the matrix. And that's going to be the kernel of the linear transformation. But that that discussion I'll delay until Wednesday and let you guys go today. Let me remind you that problem set 6 is due today unofficially, by the end of the semester officially. And do have a look at those problems because we're going to be doing calculations that kind of depend on finding bases for the column space of a matrix, bases for the null space of a matrix. So you need to be able to do that. And that's so that you'll understand what's going on as we start to work with linear transformations.
Thank you.